Thank you very much for the organizers to have allowed me and asked me to speak today to all of you. And it's a great pleasure to be in Vancouver once again. Let me start with perhaps a very simple, well-known premise. The whole process of knowledge construction, the whole process of knowledge discovery is based basically on a conversation. And the conversation has been developing through time with a number of various tools which have, in a sort of way, instrumentally helped develop that conversation, but have also contributed to changing the very nature of the conversation. Let me deal with the second problem first, as it is perhaps the one that is not as well known as the other one. Let's go back for a minute to the 3rd century of the Common Era, around Caesarea in the Eastern Mediterranean, where Origen was trying to put some order into the mess that Christianity had become at the time. I mean by this, at the time when all sorts of documents were floating around, communities were doing their thing around Christianity, and the Roman Empire itself was having some major difficulties maintaining itself. We're still talking about empires in passing. Origen tried to put some order in that, and to do that, he essentially recast, technically, the Codex. He took the Codex, and he started saying, we need to try and really understand what the best text is for the biblical tradition. So he took the Hebrew text, a Hebrew text that he trusted, and he wrote it letter by letter. And then for those who didn't know any Hebrew, he transliterated that directly into Greek, letter by letter. So it was a Hebrew text written in Greek letters. And then he proposed 4 translations, word by word, line by line, of these texts. And in that fashion developed a tool which was called the Hexapla, which is now estimated to have included at least 40 or 50 large codices. Now, in so doing, what his intention is to fix a text and to validate a text. Objectives which look extremely simple, and he has an instrument. He's using the Codex in that fashion. In doing so, what he did not realize that he was doing was that he was displacing the very function of reading from what it used to be. Reading in the classical world, especially when you were using scrolls, but even with the codices, was really leaning on a text which was written as a safety net for something you already knew, and you read aloud, and you read to a public, and you tried to just make sure that you were following the right text by having this support, this kind of prompting device called writing. That's what the writing was doing in the kind of reading that was done at the time. When Origen began to describe, to organize this codex with his columns, comparisons, and very, very careful confrontations of translations and the like, the reading became critical, it became synoptic, it became silent too. Your people were just thinking about, is that the right word that goes with that word? It became an entirely different exercise. And out of that, you might say that you find the first roots in the Mediterranean basin of the tradition of critical analysis and interpretation, which have become, of course, so important in developing cultural traditions of that region of the world. I think in some ways the present transition to the digital world is treated, by and large, instrumentally, just as Origen was treating the Codex to achieve a certain obvious goal, and at the same time is beginning to introduce shifts which are probably going to change the very nature of the conversation, the very meaning of the conversation, and perhaps, in fact, the very meaning of what knowledge is all about. Now, that is a very bold assertion, but I would like to try and show some examples of it that might help understand what is probably coming along in the next few decades, which is a bold bold assertion, I realize that, but I like to speculate sometimes. When the print book came along, some areas of knowledge, which were well validated at the time and were well accepted at the time, chose not to use the printed book. One of them, and you'll smile because now it is no longer a validated form of knowledge, but it was then, one of them, alchemy, was in that category in the Western world. When the printed book came along, alchemy maintained its propagation through manuscripts and through a private, almost secret kind of training sessions. And in a recent article that was published in this marvelous anthology that Jardine and some Frasca Spalda, I think, published in 2000 called Books, the Sciences, and the Sciences in History, there is an article there showing that the reading of these manuscripts, alchemical manuscripts, was very different from the kind of reading we're doing. You were taking those manuscripts and you were sort of meditating on them over and over and over and over until somehow at some point the mystery, the secret would sort of spark up and you would understand what was going on. You knew how to do the Philosopher's Stone, and in that fashion, the ascetic, the moral, the whole spiritual dimension of alchemy merged with the operational, lab-oriented, and so on. And you'll see much later on in printed books, because ultimately alchemy became printed when actually it became also marginal. curiously, you'll see many illustrations in which in the same drawing, the same person is praying and manipulating on the lab, depending on the part of the picture that you look at. Very different form of reading from the kind of reading that we are used to. It's even more than this distinction that the German school in the history of reading has developed, namely the 18th century transition between what they call intensive reading and extensive reading. Intensive reading is the kind of reading that you do when in your family you read over and over again the Bible and you meditate on that. But you don't do it in the kind of deep spiritual sort of ascesis that the alchemist is doing. It's getting there, but not that intense. Extensive reading is more or less the kind of reading we do. We buy books, we read them, we may keep them because we're fetishists, but we don't read them very often again. How many books have you read twice? A very small proportion of your collection, probably. In my opinion, you're unusual. So you have these kinds of transformation in the reading, in the understanding of what knowledge is all about, and the development of communities that create that knowledge that we have to keep in mind to, I think, bring about an understanding of what's going on now. Now let me jump fast forward to the present and look at the scientific communication as it is now. Most of you, I'm sure, know that quintessential Hollywood scene on television of the prison scene, you know, where you have the prisoner speaking to his wife or his lawyer through a telephone with, you know, a big glass pane in between. Now, this is, of course, for security reasons and all sorts of things like that. What's interesting is that you allow communication, but you restrict it in very, very, very strange ways. If you try to transpose the way scientists communicate nowadays with this kind of image in mind, you would have a system in which, first of all, some of the telephones would be inaccessible, some of the telephones would be extremely expensive, some of the telephones would have extraordinarily bad sound, some of the telephones would give you the message only after half an hour. You would have a series of obstacles and delays in the way things are transmitted, which, of course, when you think about the great scientific conversation, brings you to an inescapable conclusion: why the hell is it that way? And the reason why it is that way is that two agendas have collided, which have been two agendas which have been described over and over, I think, in the course of this conference. The agenda of the publishers on the one hand, and the agendas of the researchers on the other hand. The second thing which has happened along in time is that, and this brings me to the granularity issue in the title of my talk, The second thing that has arrived in history is a change in that granularity, which again is important to look at. At the beginning, people speak. Then they begin to use writing, and with the emergence of a postal system, they start exchanging letters. Some of these letters are extremely long. Some people publish those letters as a way to document a controversy. Tycho Brahe did that at one point in the 16th century, the well-known astronomer from Denmark who ultimately worked in Prague. The journal appeared and transposed the letter into the journal format, and then that granularity of the article began. And it sort of standardized after a while, and to the point that nowadays when you see a young colleague who wants to write an article, he'll think spontaneously about the 25-page double space sort of format that is also by mystery the format of most term papers and so on and so forth. And there's a kind of, it reminds me of the situation that developed in the recording industry, which after people developed the role, the cylinder, I mean, and then the disc, the vinyl disc, was limited by the amount of information you could put on that, and that more or less led to our three-minute songs. And we have three-minute songs. We've had that practically ever since, even though by now we don't need that constraint. So we have this kind of granularity that developed. It also was a challenge to another granularity, which remained very dominant in most disciplines for a long time, and now has disappeared from practically all disciplines except the humanities, namely the monograph. No scientist nowadays would do what Darwin did in the 19th century. No scientist would publish a book to announce a new discovery. It's too slow, too cumbrous, too big a way of doing it. You publish articles. So you have to see what's going to happen in our digital world, also in that perspective of a system of communication which started with very bulky, heavy, I would say awkward forms of granularity, all the way to already more flexible, more subtle, more quicker, lighter forms of communication through the article. Going into the digital age, not surprisingly, we carry over the habits that we've had in the print world. So we are carrying over the whole notion of the article as it has been developed. The open journal system is a way to manage the process leading to the production of an article, and I think it's very legitimate to do so, and it's not a critique, John, that might think so. I think it's a step we have to go through, and we have to do it well. But at the same time, one has to ask oneself, is that going to be the end point of the whole system? Are we just going to do electronically that what we were doing in print? Well, again, history tells us that when print came along, in the first 50 years, they did in print what they were used to doing in manuscript form. And the incunabula are, by and large, imitations of manuscripts. Likewise, we are imitating the print world right now, and I think the best example of that is the famous PDF format, which is really a desperate attempt to make the digital world look like paper. And that's, I think, my best definition for PDF. The situation, though, is evolving already. Exactly as the article came to challenge the monograph gradually in more and more sectors of disciplines and more disciplines, in the same fashion, we begin to see a sort of erosion at the edges of the article world. We've seen, again, many examples of this in this conference. People adding blogs and wikis to the articles, the discussions about open peer review, the issues of allowing people to comment on the articles, and so on and so forth. And right now it's still a kind of clear world for us with our habits, because we can still see the article in its neat shape and all these little satellites starting to gravitate around them. But don't make any mistake about that. Before long, the parasites are going to get inside the cell, and the cell is going to be transformed and lead to something else. So I think what we are going to see is a change in the kinds of possibilities that people can, levels of intervention rather, that people can avail themselves of in order to contribute to the construction of knowledge. Let me give you a very simple example. You read an article. It's a good article, but there is one small glaring error in it. What is the possibility of correcting that right now? In print, none. Or if you want to correct it, you have to republish another article and try to embed that correction in it, hoping that people will make the connection between the two. It's not a given. Nowadays, you can, of course, react to that with exactly this kind of level of intervention. Many of our colleagues actually are very good at doing precisely that, but are not so good at doing longer documents and longer forms of work. That means that these people whose good intellect, but which is channeled through means of expression which are more like this burst of interaction, are going to now to be able to intervene in the great conversation and are going to be able to participate in the elaboration of knowledge. Now, this is, I think, going to intensify, and we already have, as far as we can see, a sort of end point of all this evolution, which is going to be pretty exciting, it seems to me. Now, I'm going to say the word that's going to make some of you totally, shiver, and yet I think it's important to put it in this context. I'm talking about scholarly and scientific communication. I think that we're going to see a gradual evolution towards a Wikipedia model. That is where people are actually aggregating around some sort of issue that they can create together by just putting the name of that issue and then starting putting text around it. And then people are going to start changing, adding, modifying, optimizing, improving that text until it is left dormant for a while, until it moves again and so on, or begins to drift on the margins of the interest centers of a given community of human beings. So we could see that, in a sense, if we go to the Wikipedia system and we think again about my prison example of early, we can see that we are starting to develop a system in which the glass panes are disappearing, the telephones are disappearing, the delays are disappearing, the bad sound, the costs are being gradually eroded and are disappearing. And the conversation is going on. And more brains are being brought to bear on any problem at any given point. Now you're going to say to me, yeah, but the quality issue, you know, that famous quality issue. And that's where I'm going to go back to my first point, which was the transformation of knowledge and its meaning. We have so grown used to a system in which people arrive with a credential in their hands, namely a diploma of some sort, a PhD or something like that. And then by virtue of having done the necessary exercises to gain that particular kind of credential, then they have the right to validate. They do what Origen did. They put themselves in a position of power in which they say, I can say things that are credible about that. And then the rest of the population that doesn't have that kind of credential essentially has nothing to do except either read and try and understand or even consume that sort of thing, which is the worst form of interaction, or simply dismiss it and not pay attention to it. And we want, in a sense, we want to think about knowledge in this tiered fashion in which there is a bunch of priests, and I am choosing the words very, very carefully, bunch of priests who validate the existence of some texts, and the rest of the population is supposed to more or less integrate the lessons from what has been validated in the canon. I think what we are moving towards is a world which is the world that Benkler has been discussing in his book. Instead of having what he calls in the first third of his book, this society of what he calls the red, the blues, and the greens, that is, the reds are this priesthood that essentially at a very definite point gives out the message that is going to inform all the storytelling in a society. And the blues is essentially the same thing, but through a kind of voting mechanism, which you can recognize through the through what's going on in advertising in television. And we are moving to an entirely different system in which the population, the brains in general, are contributing in a distributed manner without any a priori about who has the right and who doesn't have the right to do something. It's just a question of letting people express what they think they can say about the subject and then have the collective wisdom put that through the critical analysis that it has to go through, and that thing will stand or fall on its merit after having been critically, attacked, maybe, even by that pertinent crowd around that particular issue. So what I'm saying is that if we move through that change in granularity that is beginning to show itself up more and more beyond the granularity of the article, which had become dominant in the production of knowledge, if we start having not only systems of commentaries and systems of interactions and system of evaluations that are grafted onto the old system, but rather systems of production of knowledge where all of this is integrated in one whole, not only are we facilitating the whole system, the whole communication of science, but we are suddenly displacing it completely in a way which I think we should be fairly happy about. Many of us have lived in the shadow of what is often called the ivory tower. And we quite often tear our hair in the universities by saying, people don't understand what we do, and so on and so forth. The whole point is that why should there be people and us? We may, as individuals, not as a category, not as a genre, we may have some skills that have been acquired and or that we have naturally to do the kind of work we want to do. But the rest of the public has also its contribution to make, and it also has its uses to develop around these particular documents. So open access, to conclude, now comes into perspective in a way which I think is extraordinarily interesting, because open access is not simply opening the access to a wider population, to making the thing more democratic, making it more, you know, nicer and so on and so forth. That's all very nice, and I'm all for that, of course. But open access also is a promise of relocating, repositioning, redefining the meaning of what the construction of knowledge is about, what its functions are, what its utility is, and how it relates not to a few elites that then disdainfully or perhaps benignly give it away to the rest of the population, not in that fashion, but rather as a big distributed conversation where everybody contributes how he can and what he can. It sounds like Marx, I know, but it, I'll take that very without any problem, and letting the knowledge evolve also in terms of, I would say, the fields of forces that are really at work in a society at a given time, so that real questions are really addressed and frivolous questions may be left a bit behind. Thank you very much.